I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are doing a special show today. Our guest is Jason Kessler. Jason, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be with you.
So everybody and their uncle is glued to social media. I wish we could be watching it live, streamed on television, to follow the Charlottesville trial, Sines v. Kessler et al. And who better to talk about Sines v. Kessler from our point of view than Kessler himself? And so we are doing a special fundraiser also for Jason. And if you would like to help out today, we are going to donate all of the DLive tokens that you send in from this point forward to Jason and his cause. And also, if you want to send any super chats through Entropy at entropystream.live/countercurrents, the super chats that are connected with Unite the Right, we'll send that minus the processing fee, of course, and everything to Jason as well to help out. One of the things that this money goes towards is things like transcripts. I've been reading the transcripts and I've been glued to this trial. This is absolutely fascinating, and it's a great crime that this is not being televised, because there's some real drama here and some real lessons here, and maybe not the lessons that the plaintiffs, this organization of basically activists who are trying to suppress white identity politics, want to teach. So I think this is a fascinating, fascinating drama going on. And I want to thank Jason for coming on and sharing it. So Jason, just give us a little bit of background on this suit. Who's being sued and who are the people behind the suit, and what kind of suit is it? It's a civil suit. It's not a criminal action. It's a civil suit. So give us the background.
Yeah, that's right. This is a civil suit because the evidence just would not even come close to supporting a criminal allegation. It barely is enough to make it into a civil courtroom. This is to do with the Unite the Right rally that I was the permit holder for in 2017 in Charlottesville, Virginia. The police stood down and allowed Antifa and the permitted protesters to fight in the streets. The event was shut down, and all kinds of chaos ensued afterwards. So these liberal activist groups and Jewish activist groups got together this lawsuit spearheaded by a nonprofit group called Integrity First for America, run by a former communications director for a Israeli NGO in Washington, D.C., J Street. Amy Spitalnik is her name. The head litigators are Karen Dunn, who used to clerk for Merrick Garland, the current attorney general, and Roberta Kaplan, who did the famous Supreme Court gay marriage case. So basically, they accuse us of not actually planning to demonstrate, but to conspiratorially motivated violence. And they sued dozens of people because they have the resources to do it. They're funded by the ADL, PLC, Silicon Valley billionaires, Hollywood actors. So these this group, Integrity First for America, sued about two dozen individuals, including myself, Christopher Cantwell, Richard Spencer, Michael Hill, Michael Tubbs, League of the South, Traditionalist Workers Party, and some groups that didn't really have anything to do with the rally, as far as my knowledge, Imperial Wizards, the Ku Klux Klan, or something that had absolutely nothing to do with the rally. And that's where we're at right now.
Okay, so the trial, how much money was raised for this trial? And what is the purpose of the trial? What do the plaintiffs hope to get out of it?
Well, we can only speculate about how much they have raised to this point because the IRS disclosures are running a couple of years behind where we're at now. My most recent VDARE article, which you can find on my website, jasonkessler.us, has links to their IRS 990 forms for 2017, 2018, and 2019. And as of that time, they'd raised almost $10 million. And so it's been a couple years since then. So you'd have to figure that they're closer to 15 or 20 by this point, for sure. A lot of that money has come from tech billionaires like Reid Hoffman, the co-founder of LinkedIn. They also count Craig Newmark from Craigslist amongst their supporters, the actress Natalie Portman, the actor Topher Grace. This is really a Jewish activist thing. I mean, all of these individuals I've named are people who've been kind of instigated by this nonprofit that is trying to make it sound like the demonstrators of Unite the Right are victimizing these people, and they try to connect us to various incidents of violence that have happened, including January 6th and the shooting in New Zealand, and we don't have anything to do with those things. You know, I had a permit to protest that was violently disrupted, but that's what we're up against. And so, they're hoping to shut down a lot of groups and their abilities to assemble and protest.
So are they trying to get damages for people who were injured in the Unite the Right riot, basically, that took place after the protest was shut down?
Supposedly. And to be fair, there are some individuals who have very serious injuries related to the car incident when James Fields drove his car into a crowd of people. And those people have had rehabilitation and medical expenses and deserve sympathy. But we didn't have anything to do with that. This is a conspiracy lawsuit, and James Fields has been prosecuted. He's going to spend the rest of his life in prison. He never communicated with anybody about driving into a car, crowd of people. He didn't conspire with anybody. And so these are the totally false allegations. What's more than that is, I'm not sure that even a single person that they're suing could actually pay them any of these damages if they were ordered to do it. Some of these individuals like Richard Spencer and Christopher Cantwell are totally destitute, I guess, and they're representing themselves. They can't even afford an attorney. How are they going to pay these plaintiffs?
Right, exactly. And yet part of the pretense that these people have is that this is to help people who suffered because of the conspiracy of the Unite the Right people to cause violence. And yet none of the people in this have any deep pockets. So it's not like there's going to be any money that is going to go into the pockets of these victims who are being paraded out. And you hear about their suffering, et cetera. And yet there's really no possibility that any money is going to be extracted from the Unite the Right participants. However, tens of millions of dollars have been raised to prosecute this suit by people who, I guess, they could just write checks to all these poor victims if they feel badly enough about it. But that money is going to go into the pockets of law firms. So there's something weird and kind of farcical about this. Obviously, if they wanted to help these car crash victims, they would go to people with deep pockets. And, you know, they've raised a lot of money, but none of that's going to the car crash victims. So what has the money been raised for? What is the real purpose of this suit? It's basically what people call a slap suit, I understand. And Roberta Kaplan, who spearheaded this, has basically said that this is an attempt to just harm political dissidents.
Yeah, I mean, they're exploiting these actual victims of the car incident. And I've seen videos where Roberta Kaplan talks about this, and she's literally smiling and laughing about it like it's some kind of joke. I mean, it's a real sick joke. And she just wants to silence political dissidents that she doesn't agree with because they've said words that hurt her feelings or whatever. But that is the most sacred type of speech in the First Amendment. You know, you have to protect the stuff that makes people angry and causes dispute. Yeah, she could have given all this money to these victims, but instead, you know, they're saying that the money is pro bono, but I've looked at those IRS disclosures. It's going to their law firms, and it's, and some portion of it, at least over $500,000 has been funneled to shady Democrat operations in Washington, D.C. About $600,000 was given to Fusion GPS. That was the corrupt organization behind Russiagate, which was paying Russians for the phony dossier saying Trump was peeing on prostitutes in Moscow or whatever.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And the truth of the matter is that there was a conspiracy that led to the chaos in Charlottesville. But it was a conspiracy of people in the city government of Charlottesville, people in the state, the office of the governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia, and certain activist groups, including the domestic terrorists that we know as Antifa. These people were conspiring to create create chaos, basically. And these people have deep pockets. I'm not talking about Antifa, although they probably get lots of plane tickets from the likes of George Soros and things like that. But I'm talking about the city of Charlottesville and the state of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia. They are quite responsible and have been held responsible to some extent by their own report, the Heafy report. And yet, if people really cared about these car crash victims, you'd think that they would go after the real conspirators who also have deep pockets and could also actually pay out money to these poor victims whose injuries and suffering are being exploited here for sympathy.
Yeah, I mean, the First Amendment law is pretty clear that although police don't normally have a duty to protect citizens, they do when it comes to the First Amendment. It's called the heckler's veto. And theoretically, these counter-protesters might have been able to sue on similar grounds. I mean, even though they didn't have a permit, and we did, you know, I mean, that you don't necessarily need a permit to demonstrate under the First Amendment. But Roberta Kaplan specifically convinced them not to do that. She told them, I understand that you have injuries and you have great costs, but if you sue the police, you can't be in our lawsuit. That's directly what she told them. And it's a shame too, because I mean, we get so hunkered down in the fact that there was this assault on our specific dissident movement, but there were people from across the political spectrum at that rally on both the left and the right who were hurt by the actions of the Charlottesville government. And it's so easy to scapegoat the people who said mean words, you know, when you have a police chief and a city manager who said, let them fight, who ordered this thing to happen. They instigated a riot. They knew that Antifa was going to be fighting with the demonstrators. And that's just what we know. We don't know how far up it went. You know, there's other lawsuits going on where different phone records are being subpoenaed. And I'm hearing there were people who were on the ground talking to the president of the World Bank at the time. Why were people at the Unite the Right rally talking to somebody like that? And what about Terry McAuliffe, you know, the guy who just lost the governor's race in Virginia? He was governor in 2017. And the Virginia State Police also stood down, not just the Charlottesville police. Who ordered that? You know, was there somebody above Terry McAuliffe? And why was the FBI in the so-called command center when the chief of police and the city manager were ordering the stand down? Why have none of these government officials been held to account? Why has the FBI not prosecuted a single Antifa who attacked the rally? There are a lot of questions, and I don't think this thing stops at just the city officials, but we will never know if this phony, fake signs lawsuit succeeds. I have a lawsuit against the Charlottesville government, and that is the lawsuit that has to prevail for us to get the answers about this.
That's absolutely fantastic. The sheer level of farce here, the sheer disdain for justice and truth, it's just breathtaking. Again, if you really wanted to help the poor victims who are being brought out, and you see the film of their bodies flying through the air, and you hear the talk of their trauma and their costs and their suffering, if these people were really anything more than just exhibits in a politically motivated show trial, the people on trial would be the real conspirators, the people who caused this riot, the people who have deep pockets and could be held responsible, but that's not happening at all. So instead, we have people who were victims here, victims of a conspiracy, who are being charged as conspirators. And the purpose is not to extract money from them to help the victims. The purpose is basically to ruin their lives, to shut their organizations down, and to send a message that if you stand up for Southern heritage or white identity or anything like that, that these people will be, you know, given ungodly amounts of money to ruin your life.
Yeah, I mean, the victims, instead of helping these victims, they've weaponized them. And it's a shame because when you listen to a lot of the testimony, you can tell that they've been coached to say certain phrases to try and really stick it to the defendants in this case. And there's just really a lack of a factual basis for the things that they're saying. They keep repeating this mythologized version of the events of August 11th and 12th, like on August 11th, during the torch protest on UVA campus, that it was just UVA students, innocent, fresh-faced, you know, unarmed, harmless, when the reality is there were armed Antifa with guns, with pepper spray, with expandable ass batons. You had, like, serious, sick, people who were there at that protest to attack our demonstrators. You had Paul Menton, who basically watched his friend murder a man with a hammer and then helped dispose of the body. Then when he got out of prison, he became an Antifa. You had Paul Massey, or Tom Massey, and Tom Keenan, who were recently arrested, ironically, for attacking Hispanic Marines and calling them racial slurs because they thought they were Nazis or Proud Boys or whatever. Then you had Lindsay Moores, who was attacking people with an ASP baton from behind, helpless people. The FBI actually had gotten a search warrant against her and had fully documented her crimes on both August 11th and August 12th. You had Holly Zoller and Sean Leiter, who participated in some of the George Floyd-related riots in 2020 in Kentucky, and they came with guns and other deadly devices. But you hear it's just students, you know, they just attack for no reason because they're just violent, bloodthirsty people. And then when it comes to August 12th, I mean, there was a coordinated, a real conspiracy, as you say, to attack our rally. And they've admitted it. You know, they went on their podcast and talked about how they had command squads and they were organized. They had a comms director who was telling them where to attack. Their plan was to run into the park and attack people and draw them out where they would be outnumbered and undefended and then brutally maim them. And the purpose of this was to cause enough violence to get the police to declare an unlawful assembly. But yet when you hear these plaintiffs talk, it's like, yeah, it's just students and moms. And, you know, Cantwell had a good line when he was cross-examining one of these plaintiffs where he said, yeah, students, moms, babies, puppies, things like that, right? Because it's just like this totally fictional version of events.
Yeah. Yes, a wall of moms. Yeah, I love that kind of rhetoric that these people use. They were carrying apple pies and wearing red checked aprons and smiling, smiling benevolently, right? Well, anyway, this is fascinating. So let's actually get into some of the actual testimony. Who's been on the stand? And who's been questioning them and things like that. I have to say that my surprise favorite for this trial so far, I've been following as much as I can and reading transcripts. My favorite guy so far is Chris Cantwell. I have to say, I never liked Cantwell. I thought, oh my God, isn't this an obviously toxic attention whore, a bad guy? And yet his performance here has been pretty admirable. So let's talk about the opening statements. I thought Cantwell gave a very credible opening statement.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've had sympathy for Cantwell for a while. We've gone back and forth, and sometimes we get along and sometimes we don't. But I feel a lot of sympathy for the plight of an indigent man who's being railroaded by the system. And right now, Christopher Cantwell is in prison for an unrelated crime. And he doesn't have legal representation, doesn't have money to hire one. He's being kept in some communications management, or he was being kept in a communications management facility that's like what they keep ISIS or something in. And so he hasn't had communication with the outside world. They weren't sending him the documents for this case. And then when he finally was able to get some small bits of information, he would basically handwrite legal documents to try and, you know, fight back in this thing. So I think being in prison and, you know, kind of being away from the provocations of the internet and this kind of stuff has really mellowed him out. And I think he's a highly intelligent person. So he's really rising to the occasion and the challenge here, and trying to push back. All of the attorneys have certain legal strategy. It doesn't play on the internet like some of the pro se guys. Of course, everybody loves what Cantwell is doing. He's highly entertaining, and he's bringing up a lot of the arguments that people who are at the event want to bring up, whereas the attorneys are just trying to win the case for their clients. And in a lot of cases, what you don't say is as important as what you do say. And that's maybe not a concept that the pro se guys know as much. But that being said, I think that there's a lot of genius to what Cantwell is doing, because he's gone in there and his opening statement was very offensive, probably, to some of those jurors. You know, he used the N-word. He recommended they read Mein Kampf. Like, you wouldn't think that these things would work, but there's a strategy that is working among some of the defendants, which I think helps, is just to be honest about who they are. Because part of the prosecution is they're trying to make it seem like we're hiding who we are. Like, we use code words, and like, you can't trust them just because they say they didn't do any violent conspiracy, that everything they do is in code. And then you have like people like Cantwell just coming out and just being totally honest about it. And I think to his, you know, credit, you know, to their credit, other defendants like Matt Heimbach, who really performed a lot better than I would have expected from him. Much better.
I agree. Well, I agree with that. Yeah.
So I think what helped was they owned their offensive stuff and they relaxed and had fun with it. There was even an exchange where Matt Heimbach was talking about the difference between whether we call it dinner or supper in the South. And I thought that was a very charismatic moment for him. I definitely heard the jurors laughing at some of the things that Christopher Cantwell has said. Believe it or not, I've heard, although I didn't personally hear it, I've heard that they've even laughed at some of the things that Richard Spencer have said.
Well, that's interesting. The strategy of the plaintiffs here is basically this. They can't show a conspiracy. Most of these people never communicated with one another. And that, I think, is going to be very, very hard for them to prove. They can't really prove a conspiracy. So they're just sort of hand-waving in that direction and hoping that people on the jury are stupid and don't ask questions. And then what they're really trying to do is they're trying to get these jurors to send a message that they don't like hate, right? And so what do they make it about? They make it about impeaching the characters of all the people who are on trial. These are bad people. You must send a message that you don't agree with these bad people. You must convict them of something that they didn't do. That's what the plaintiffs are banking on. That's their strategy. It's utterly cynical. And the only way to combat it is to be either squeaky clean, and some of these defendants are far from that. And if they're not squeaky clean, they've got to just get out ahead of it and own it and say, look, I am, I mean, put it this way. If Richard Spencer said, look, I stipulate that I'm an asshole, but I'm not on trial for being an asshole. It is not against the law to be an asshole. Saying offensive things is protected by the First Amendment. I am all these things. I will stipulate to that. It doesn't have anything to do with the conspiracy charge. And that's what Cantwell has done. I think Heimbach has done that. They've gotten out ahead of this, and they've owned it, and they basically have tried to frame this in such a way that it's not relevant. And indeed, it isn't relevant. And the only way that this could really be used against them, and it's going to hurt them. There's no question about it. I mean, that's the whole strategy, is just to make them out to be bad people. But it's going to be far more effective if they run and hide from it, or equivocate about it, or backpedal or apologize, because then it really does become about their character, which is strictly speaking not relevant.
Yeah. Well, that's what they did to Richard Spencer. I think he's the only one who didn't really own it. He owned it later in his testimony, and I think he started to get a little bit better. But very early on, they would ask him things that they clearly had the goods on him for, where they'd say, well, did you ever say that, you know, like Blacks and Hispanics are the underclass and are meant to serve you, or something like that? And you say, no, I've never said that. And then they literally play him the audio where he said that. And they did that several times, to the point where his voice was shaking and he was getting roughed up pretty bad. But to his credit, he did eventually figure out what the deal was and corrected his course.
Well, in his opening statement, he got out ahead of this and said, you know, I'm the villain, right? Or basically, I've said a lot of things that you're going to think are villainous, and it doesn't matter. The other thing that I thought was effective, and I think it needs to be really played up, is his handling of this notorious rant where he's screaming about octoroons and midgets and kikes or whatever after the rally had gone bad. It literally sounds it sounds insane, or it sounds like some guy who's trying to act like he's crazy. I don't know, but it's kind of disturbing, and it's quite, you know, vile stuff. It's bad stuff. And the best thing he can say about that is that this is not the reaction that he would have had if he had conspired to create violence, right? If he'd conspired to create violence, he would have been clucking and rubbing his hands together in glee over what had happened at the thing. But instead, the thing descends into violence. The crowd is dispersed. He can't speak, et cetera, et cetera. And what's his reaction? It's unhinged rage and indignation. That's clearly not the reaction of a guy who was conspiring to create the shit show that actually went down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he was actually interrupting me. I was there in that room when it happened, and he he was doing that rant to shut me down and shut me up. So he and I just didn't see eye to eye throughout this process. And that's part of the real record of the event that is going to have to come into the defense, is that, you know, they say we're all conspiring with each other, but in some cases, the people hated one another. And I hate Richard Spencer. You know, he hates me. I did not conspire with him to do anything. And there were many other people who did not trust one another and broke off from one another and did their own thing. And I think it's pretty implausible that those people could have conspired with one another with that level of distrust.
Yeah, yeah. It's also very interesting. You got text messages between Spencer and Klein where they are conspiring. And what are they conspiring to do? They're conspiring to cut you out of the thing that you created, basically. You created a nice rally here. It'd be a shame if somebody, you know, just sort of came in and took it over. I mean, that's basically what they were doing. They were going to come in and take over your rally, and that's the substance of their exchange. So yeah, that's obviously not the behavior of people who are all on the same page.
Right, exactly. I mean, Klein, his intentions towards me were borderline murderous. I mean, not only did he take the rally from me, but he was going around to people and saying, let's dogpile him, let's drive him to the brink of suicide. I mean, that's sick mentality. It's not a mentality that a grown man should have either. Like, I don't know how old he is. He was in his late 20s, early 30s. That's like some twisted teenager type behavior. But yeah, clearly I was not conspiring with that guy.
Yeah, yeah, that's definitely, yeah, it's definitely going to be very hard for them to prove a conspiracy, which is why they simply have to put all of you on trial and say you're bad people, and the jurors have to show that they're good people and send a message against hate. That's the cynical strategy that these people have come up with. They've had 4 years, they've been, you know, basically throwing tens of millions of dollars into the furnace, you know, with this this thing, and that's the best that they can come up with. Basically, just misdirect, put people on trial, just make it a farce, make it a shit show.
Yeah, I think that a lot of it is not landing the way that they thought, though. I mean, starting with jury selection, I think they thought it was all going to be Charlottesville leftists, but it's not just Charlottesville. This isn't a state trial. This is a federal trial, and it's the entire Western District of Virginia, which includes lots of people from the country who believe a lot of the same things we do. Maybe not everything, but they support the monuments. They believe that there's an epidemic of anti-white racism. They don't like Antifa. And there were more people in that jury pool that said Antifa are troublemakers or even terrorists than these people could possibly strike from the jury. There were that many of them. And so I think that they were really blown away by that. And we got, I think, a great jury. It's a mixture of white and black. I think most of them are country people, maybe like two from Charlottesville, one or two. But these are salt of the earth people. They seem like good, honest people who are going to give us a fair shake. And then it moved on from there up to recently. They had their first expert witness, Deborah Lipstadt, who is the current anti-Semitism czar for the Biden administration. And they were building this up like it was going to be the scene and the next movie memorializing the further adventures in court of Deborah Lipstadt. And it really just did not go as planned. I think they rushed it through because the jury was bored with it. Who cares what happened in World War II as far as this trial is concerned? It has nothing to do with that. And I think it was really...
It doesn't take an expert to determine that Matt Heimbach is anti-Semitic. He's right out there in the open about that.
Yeah, so, they totally misjudged this thing as far as like all their expert witnesses are trying to be like, here are the coded symbols that show you that these people are anti-Semitic. And like, they're literally saying that, and you're wasting our time with these expert witnesses. I think they thought that they were, all these people were going to be hiding their beliefs or something. Their First Amendment protected beliefs, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. So who are some of the other people that you think have testified? Well, I have not read the transcript yet, but I was sort of following along with Michael Hill's testimony. And the guy seems surprisingly based. I had no idea. I didn't know much about him or the League of the South, to be honest.
Yeah, I think Michael Hill was very powerful. You know, I think that he's going to appeal to a lot of the white Southerners in particular. He stands for the South, you know, and he stands for traditional values that everybody growing up in the South, their parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles believed. You know, so it's just because the media in the last 10 years have tried to tell us that stuff is so unusual or wrong doesn't make it so. And and in his beliefs that might be a little bit different than the typical Southerner in some ways, they are like classic First Amendment protected stuff. Like they played this video of him burning an Israeli flag, a copy of the Talmud, and a copy of the the Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx. And they really thought the lawyer Alan Levine was just so worked up, and he had such an accusatory attitude, like he'd really gotten this guy by finding this video, which is a classic demonstration protected by the First Amendment. And he said, is it your belief that communism is the product of Jews? And he said, yes, it is my belief. You know, and it's like, well, okay, that's his belief. That's First Amendment protected. He's not hiding it from you. But they just kept drilling on that point over and over and over again. It's like, we got it. And I think that his authenticity and his honesty about that is going to show the jury that he has nothing to hide.
Yeah, I think that's great. We have an amazing match here. We've got these pampered, wealthy people, mostly Jewish, from this echo chamber, this establishment echo chamber, against a bunch of outsiders who are practically penniless for the most part. And I think the outsiders are doing an outstanding job. And these wealthy, privileged insiders look really, really weak. I'm thinking, is this the establishment that rules us? And do they have much longer? If this is the establishment that rules us, their days are numbered.
Yeah, I mean, they're coming across as pretty toothless to me. I mean, granted, I'm sure that the jury are listening to some of the things that some of the opinions people have, or the use of slurs or whatever, and it's going to come across as offensive to them. You have to put yourself in the mind of the actual jurors who are, you know, normal men and women on the street. They're not in the dissident politics or whatever. But even that being said, I think that these defendants are coming across very well. They were prepared for it. They're poised. I think that Roberta Kaplan and her allies are just so used to having their way in their bubble in New York City, where everybody thinks like they do. And, you know, they're it's such a corrupt city, New York. And they get patted on the back. They're in the club. It's very different here in Virginia. And I think that they thought that all of these defendants were going to be their stereotype of a dumb, racist redneck, like stupid, incompetent. And these aren't even like the rank and file of their political movement. These are people who love being public figures. These are people who wanted to be the speakers at a political rally, a high-profile political rally. And especially, I think, for some of them who might have fallen out of favor or been deplatformed and really haven't been the focus of attention for a while, I think they really relished being able to perform in front of people again. And their charisma really showed through.
Yeah, I think this is a great sort of David and Goliath type story. To borrow something from the Bible and cause Deborah Lipstadt to get angry, I imagine. But yeah, this is definitely a kind of inspiring populist tale. I hope to God you guys all win, because you certainly didn't do what they're claiming you for doing.
I think we have a good shot, and so far so good. Only about halfway through, though.
Right. So let me ask you a couple more things. Who has yet to take the stand? We've seen Richard Spencer, Elliot Klein, or Eli Mosley was deposed. He hasn't come to this. We've seen Heimbach. We've seen Michael Hill. We've seen Cantwell. You haven't taken the
stand. Cantwell hasn't testified yet.
He made an opening statement and he's represented himself. So who's made opening statements so far? And then who's actually been on the stand and who's been cross-examining?
Well, everybody that was going to make an opening statement already. But the only two pro se defendants are Cantwell and Spencer. And so we're seeing a lot more of them than we are of any of the other defendants. A lot of the parties just aren't going to be showing up at all. A lot of them have defaulted or really shouldn't have even been in this lawsuit to begin with. Like they put two Ku Klux Klan groups that I think were at a protest in Charlottesville in July. And I think the only reason they put them in there is just to confuse the public, to confuse the jury, because the media often used photos of like Klan members in robes when they were talking about the Unite the Right rally, even though that didn't happen at our event. So they have Andrew Anglin and Moonbase Holdings and Robert Asmodor Ray and a number of people who just defaulted and aren't going to be showing up. But then you have some folks like myself who has yet to testify. Cantwell hasn't been brought on to the stand yet. There's numerous other plaintiffs, including Seth Whispleway, who is one of the radical, like extreme, extreme far left Antifa sympathizing preachers that were out there that day. And that's going to be a really interesting one to see, I think, because he is definitely not a real victim. He's a political operative. And so I think the Cantwell cross-examination of that guy in particular is going to be a lot of fun.
That sounds like great theater. So you haven't taken the stand. Nathan D'Amigo hasn't taken the stand. Will he actually be at the trial, or is he going to be deposed on?
You know, I'm not sure. I think he might be considering Zoom just because of how far he is away from Charlottesville. But I think most, although not all of the defendants are going to show up in court to testify themselves. And that's mostly, you know, as a show of respect to the judge and to the jury, because they don't have to be. And in fact, I haven't been present even one day so far, because there are COVID restrictions, which the judge has outlined. He's trying to limit the number of people in the court, especially for those who are unvaccinated. And many of the defendants are unvaccinated, so we don't have to go into the courtroom, and we can participate by Zoom.
Okay. Okay, great. Matt Parrott hasn't been called to the stand. Will he actually be taking the stand? Do you know?
I believe he will, because he is a named defendant and he has been in the courtroom, unlike many of the others who are represented by counsel. But I don't know. I mean, some of these witnesses are really drawing out the trial. They need to hurry it up. So I don't know if they'll end up skipping some of these people or not.
So of the defendants, the only ones who have actually been testifying, therefore, are Heimbach, Spencer, and Michael Hill. And in the courtroom. And then you've had an Elliot Klein, Eli Mosley video deposition. Have there been any other video depositions by defendants?
I'm trying to recall. There have been a number of witnesses who testified by pre-recorded deposition, and that sucks because we can't cross-examine them. But most of them have not actually been defendants. There was Elliot Klein, who is a defendant. There was Samantha Froelich, who is not. Ike Baker from League of the South, he might be a defendant, but I don't recall. He might not be. Who else? I don't remember the others. It might just be Elliot Klein.
Okay. That's interesting. So I look forward, though. I look forward to your testimony. I think that'll be very interesting. I look forward to seeing Matt Parrott on the stand. For the most part, this is it's good watching. And we're seeing lots of interesting redemption arcs here. There are people that I really don't like or didn't like before this. And I'm now grudgingly, to some extent, saying, yeah, I respect how especially Cantwell has behaved. I thought that Heimbach did a really credible job. I'm hoping that Parrott will do a really credible job. I think that Spencer's performance has been uneven, but better than I expected it overall. So that's a good thing. I didn't know anything about Michael Hill, but I found him super impressive. There's a lot to look forward to. Do you think they're actually going to get this trial done on time?
I don't think so, but I guess we'll see. They're already shredding a bunch of their, shedding a bunch of their witnesses, their non-party witnesses. But I don't know if that'll be enough. There's just so many defendants and so many plaintiffs. But I really do think they need to cut down on it a bit. They say that they're going to try and limit their direct examination of remaining plaintiffs to 30 to 45 minutes. I guess that'll help. Some of these jurors, they're taking time off of work. They have family, they have lives. So it's already enough for them to be out of, their daily lives for 4 weeks. That most trials are only like 3 to 7 days. So to bring it into a month or longer, I think is unnecessary. They need to try to hustle on this thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right about that. Folks, we are doing a fundraiser to help Jason with his Unite the Right campaign. This will help him with his legal costs. It's going to help him with the cost of transcripts and things like that, which are extremely important for documenting what's going on. So if you want to help Jason, look at the bottom of the screen. There's a crawler. Help Jason Kessler. Go to givesendgo.com/UTR and jasonkessler.us/donate and help out. Also, if you want to ask Jason a question about Unite the Right through Entropy at entropystream.live/countercurrents, I will pass on your super chat to him to help out. All of the DLive tokens that you throw in today will go to Jason to help out. So this is a good opportunity, not just to enjoy great content, as we like to say, but to do something helpful for the cause. And I think this trial is extremely, extremely important because if we don't combat the lies about Charlottesville, they are going to be turned into 1,000 TV movies, 1,000, false moral lessons. Future generations are going to have to suffer listening to all of these lies if we don't do our part today to blast them. And this is a great opportunity to blast these lies, because if they fail here, that's going to really shake the system's ability to cement the Charlottesville narrative permanently in the public mind. And that's very, very important. There are other things that are in the works to undermine this. A lot of people have done great work on social media and through alternative media to undermine the message about Charlottesville, which is a mountain of lies, a giant mountain of lies and sanctimony and fake sentimentality. So help out with this. Not only are you helping these defendants who are being victimized, you're helping all of us because you're helping combat the Charlottesville myth. So let's go to entropy now and see what kind of questions we have here. Niels has written in with $50. Here's November's donation, as always, given in the name of Ingwe Fryer, and a gentle reminder to ask the venerable Jim Goad about the difference between hillbillies and rednecks. I did ask him that difference, and I will have him answer that if you tune in tomorrow, because he's going to be on the writer's block with Nick Gilvey, so he can take care of that. Anonymous has sent in $120. Wow, that's very generous. Can you give some history of or explain white ethnomasochism, especially as it relates to such current extreme forms of expression of pathological altruism, corrupt aid to corrupt third world countries, radical left activism, Antifa, et cetera? That's a great question. That sort of falls outside of our discussion topic for this time. So I'm going to leave that to our next stream. Okay. But thank you, Anonymous. It's very, very generous. And we're definitely going to get to this question. Jasper has sent in $100. This goes over to Jason. The persecution of Unite the Right organizers makes a mockery of our so-called free speech. I hope justice isn't yet dead and the defendants prevail. But in truth, the damage is already done. The process is the punishment. Our enemies dismantle us using lawfare to drain our financial resources and imprison us. What are the prospects of going on the offensive and filing a countersuit against the Antifa leadership or a civil rights violation suit against the city of Charlottesville? Money is the key to defending ourselves, fighting back, and hurting these Antifa scum the way they harm us. Are there any reputable legal organizations we could support to further an organized lawfare counteroffensive? Great statement, great question. What are your thoughts, Jason?
Well, in fact, I do have a lawsuit against the city of Charlottesville, and that's part of why I'm a little bit differently situated than some of the other defendants or speakers or organizers of Unite the Right, and why I really have more of an impetus to need to raise money than some of the others do, because I've not only been funding my legal defense for the Signs case for 4 years, I've also been funding the offensive suit. There was a point where we were considering suing the Antifa in a conspiracy sort of lawsuit, the way that these groups have sued us. But ultimately, you know, our resources are very spread thin. And the truth is that the legal fund for most of this has been just coming right out of my pocket. You know, my blood, sweat, and tears, you know, what I do in my regular life. This is a very short window in which I can try to use the publicity from this thing to raise some money for the legal war chest. But we have a heckler's veto lawsuit against the city, and it's currently on appeal. Unfortunately, Judge Moon's initial ruling, I think, was totally wrong, legally speaking. And he said that the police didn't have a duty to protect, that they could just stand aside and allow a riot to ensue in order to shut down our First Amendment rights. And that's totally wrong. It's not in keeping with the precedent. And we should win on appeal. It's on the docket for the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. And I think that they're just waiting to see the outcome of the Signs case. So if I prevail here, I think we're really going to turn things around. It would be great to bring Antifa to justice, so to speak, on this stuff too. But realistically, they don't have money. They don't have money, and they're spread all over the place. It's a very different thing to sue the city of Charlottesville with deep pockets, which is insured for a ton of money, And is right there. The city of Charlottesville is literally not going anywhere. Whereas these Antifa are in Florida, they're in Philadelphia, they're in California, they're in Tennessee, and the court only has 100-mile radius jurisdiction. So we would be bleeding ourselves dry trying to track these people down in whatever Skid Row flop house they're in right now, and we would never get any money out of them. They wouldn't show up. They would be just like the indigent defendants on our side that are skipping out on this thing. So we had to make an unemotional adult decision to go after the city of Charlottesville and leave the Antifa alone this time.
I think that's wise. Go for the deep pockets. Do you have any prospect, or maybe there's the prospect of other lawyers doing this? Why not take these victims who are plaintiffs here and actually put together a lawsuit where they go after the real conspirators? There's nothing that would prevent them from doing that, is there?
Well, you know, that would have been great. You know, the statute of limitations is up for any more litigation related to Charlottesville in any direction. So that's done now. And I think Roberta Kaplan spoiled that, because her clients potentially could have sued. Now, I'm not an attorney, and I can't tell you how strong that would have been. Like I said, you don't need a permit to demonstrate under the First Amendment, but I think that my case is probably stronger than their potential case would have been, because I did go through the trouble to get a permit for my demonstration.
Right. Okay. So the decision that the jury is going to make on this is not an all or nothing thing. They're not going to, they can say, Kessler's innocent, Spencer's guilty, Heimbach's innocent, Parrott's guilty, whatever. They can basically decide on individuals, right? Even though supposedly all of these individuals that they can decide separately about were conspiring with one another, which doesn't make much sense to me. Usually with conspiracies, people, the parties to a conspiracy are held responsible for everything that happens. But in this case, I understand that they don't have to basically say it's all or nothing.
Right. And the judge has instructed them on that the numerous times, that you have to judge each defendant individually and decide whether they'd done this alleged or entered this alleged conspiracy or not.
Right. Right. Well, that's interesting. That's good. Well, honestly, I hope everybody gets off because nobody is guilty of this. None of you did anything wrong in the way of conspiracies. I guess there's a chance that some people will go free and others will be basically scapegoats, or they'll be the ones that people, you know, convict to send a message.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, it's a tough situation for some of those jurors, I would imagine, because the thing has been designed to have emotional pull. You have people who really have sustained injuries, and you know, in the eyes of some of those jurors, maybe it's not their fault that this thing was pled so badly as a conspiracy case, you know, and they might want to give them something for their pain and suffering. And we're not allowed to bring up the fact that some of these people have already raised a lot of money and have had their medical expenses covered through, you know, viral fundraising campaigns and stuff. So I think that that's going to be a thing that's going to put a lot of pressure on at least some of the jurors to try and make a decision that's emotional instead of based on the facts.
The law.
And I think that that's what the plaintiffs are banking on entirely right now.
Yeah. So 1001 Cuts has donated one Ninjagini. Hadrian was right. One Diamond. Slog, 14 Lemons. Horatius, 14, has donated an ice cream. Gaddius, 3 Lemons. Sia Kyle has donated one ice cream. Anglian, one diamond, and says, thank you. Well, thank you right back. Bartolo, one diamond. Horatius, 14, an ice cream. And Nick's Jilvy, one diamond. Cantwell's surprisingly lucid when off drugs. Yeah, I'm very impressed with how sharp this guy is. His cross-examinations are very, very sharp. And he sees the massive holes in the case, and he's exploiting them extremely well. So I'm quite impressed with Cantwell, I have to say. So let's go over to Entropy. Folks, if you want to help out, go to entropystream.live/countercurrents and send your question, comment, or donation, and we will get to it during the stream. Horatio Nelson has written in with $20. When I try to explain to people why this trial is important, they frequently don't know what actually happened. Is there a resource I can point them to so they can get up to speed? Ideally, it would be normie friendly, but it is okay if not. So what's the place that normies can go for the basic background of what's going on with this trial? What's it all about?
So I'd recommend two things. I mean, first of all, they can go to my website, jasonkessler.us, and I've written a number of articles for VDare that aren't like, they're not edgelord pieces. These are normal journalism pieces based on my research of these events. Second, there is an enormously helpful resource, which was recently published by a woman named Ann Wilson Smith. And you can find that on Amazon and through a number of other publishers. It's called Charlottesville Untold. And it really is a thoroughly researched piece of work. It includes a lot of background on my activism prior to the rally, which you really don't get a lot of. Everything that's out there on me that a normal person would see is like hit pieces and trying to make me seem like I'm some kind of lunatic neo-Nazi or something. When I was trying to do a civil rights demonstration, I was trying to stand up for American history, and this captures that. And it captures a lot of the machinations of the Charlottesville government and how lunatic some of these left-wing extremists were that were going to the Charlottesville City Council meetings, the nefarious activities of Mayor Signer and Vice Mayor Bellamy. All of the incidents of anarchist violence and how they planned it, how they celebrated it, are in this book. I just think it's an incredible resource. Charlottesville Untold. And I think it's only like $5 for the digital version.
Well, that's great. I saw a very good review of that. I believe at VDare. And
yeah, VDare has reviewed it. It's been reviewed by Paul Gottfried. It's I don't know that she's written a review yet, but it's, you know, it's been read by Ann Coulter and a number of other folks. So Jared Taylor enjoyed it. It's a really excellent piece of work, I think.
That's very good. So Man of the North writes in with $20. Again, this is going over to you, Jason. Does Jason sense that McAuliffe's recent defeat is shaking the confidence of the prosecutors? One wonders how much public opinion will weigh upon the judge and jury, and if Charlottesville residents are becoming indifferent to or exhausted with the proceedings.
You know, I can't say about the Charlottesville residents. I would imagine a number of them are sick of that. You'd be surprised how many people out there just don't follow the news, too. I mean, that's something that I realized during jury selection. Some people just aren't even aware of anything related to this event. At previous trials that I've been involved in, some of the jurors will say, oh, yeah, I know Jason Kessler. He's the guy trying to take down the statue. So never underestimate how little normal people who have busy lives know about what's going on in the news. With the judge, you know, I was very pessimistic about Judge Moon through the majority of this case. I don't think that this should have even gone to trial. I didn't like the political ideology and the conflict of interest that some of his law clerks had. But as far as since this trial has been going on, I think that he has been pretty fair. He likes to chastise the attorneys when they crossed the line, you know, as he sees it, and he does it right in front of the jury, and he does it both to Kaplan's team and he does it to the defense attorneys. He seemed to have a pretty strict code when it came to choosing the jurors on when they needed to be struck for cause or not. So just viewing him like an umpire at a baseball game, it seems like he's calling the strikes and the balls balls. And so I'm pretty happy about that.
He's a rather old guy, isn't he? How old is Judge Moon?
He's about 85, I think.
Wow. Still on the bench.
Yeah.
That might be good. I imagine if he were 35 or 40, the chances of him being extremely, extremely left-wing and woke would be much higher than an 85-year-old.
Yeah. I think that he's not in keeping with woke ideology. I don't know exactly what his personal background or beliefs are, but there was a lot of discussion of during jury selection of things like anti-white racism. And there were some jurors, like younger jurors, who would say like really bonkers things that we're used to hearing because, you know, we're on Twitter or, you know, we see the things in mainstream media where they'll say, well, it's not possible to be racist to a white person, you know, it just really hideous things like that. And Judge Moon would not react very well to that. He would, I mean, he wouldn't make like an over the top gesture about it, but you could clearly tell from his body language and his response that he thought that was an incorrect supposition.
Interesting. So Gaddius writes in with $30 again for Jason. We're pulling for all you guys, even the loathsome ones. The heckler's veto must not become codified. Yes. Fancy Pants writes in with $10. Good luck to Jason and all the other defendants. Reed Johnson writes in with $10. Thank you for bringing us quality guests like Mr. Kessler. Well, thank you, Jason, for coming on. His message is important. This show is important, and it's been an honor and a privilege to share this with all of you today. Cheers. Well, thank you so much. So, Jason, let's talk about the defense team. Who is your lawyer?
My lawyer is an attorney named James Kalinick. He's out of Cincinnati, Ohio. He's not with like a huge law firm. He has his own legal practice, the Clinic Law Office. And he was recommended to me as somebody who is, you know, he might not be have the same beliefs as us or the defendants exactly, but he is a devout Catholic and is certainly not necessarily in total lockstep with the modern world, let's say. We also have a local counsel called Elmer Woodard, and he's a attorney from Blair's, Virginia, who reached out to me in you know days or maybe in the first week at most after Charlottesville, and he got it. He understood that we were set up, that Charlottesville was a trap that was created by the government, by the police, and he's kind of a character. He's a reenactor. There's a number of photos of him dressed like, you know, in a tri-corner hat as a Revolutionary War soldier and things of this nature. He's written some books about Confederate history, Virginia history. So those are my attorneys.
Okay, who is representing trad worker Heimbach and Parrott?
Well, previously, for a long time, Trad Worker and Matt Parrott, though not Matt Heimbach, were represented by my attorneys, but just very close to trial, they broke off, and now they're working with a attorney from Pennsylvania named Josh Smith.
Okay. And who are some of the other lawyers who are working with the defendants?
Brian Jones is the only attorney that's actually from Charlottesville. And so he must be a very brave man. He is representing League of the South. And other than my attorneys, he's the only attorney that's actually been on this case for the entire 4 years, which is something you really got to give a hand to, also to League of the South for being responsible and paying their attorneys, which is important. Then you also have David Campbell, who I guess maybe technically he has been on this case the entire time. And that's because he is paid by an insurance company to represent James Fields. So he is paid out of an insurance policy that was on the Dodge Challenger. Then you have who else? There's an attorney named Edward Rebrook. It's easy to forget him because he isn't in the courtroom. He's only involved by Zoom. And he's representing the National Socialist Movement and Jeff Scoop. Unfortunately, he really hasn't had an opportunity to do things one way or the other. You often forget that he's there. And then from time to time, you'll hear a disembodied voice saying, "Objection, Your Honor, objection." And no one hears him. And he's just totally ignored. So I don't know that he's being able to give effective representation remotely like that. Let's see. Was there one other one? That might be it.
Mm-hmm. So who are the major lawyers representing the plaintiffs?
Well, as I've already stated, there's Roberta Kaplan, who has argued a case before the Supreme Court and has represented Amber Heard in one of her lawsuits against Johnny Depp. So Johnny Depp fans hate her. Like, as much as alt-right hates her, the Johnny Depp fans hate her more. And she's represented Harvey Weinstein and a lot of hedge funds and a bunch of other scumbags. Karen Dunn is another attorney that I would characterize as a Jewish identitarian activist who's using her legal profession as, a vehicle for that activism. And she's with the law firm Paul Weiss, and she's with them. There's a guy named Michael Block. I'm forgetting all of the attorneys because there are just so many. It's like a clown car where you open the door and they just keep coming out. Like every every week, there's another motion to add an attorney on here. And these are extremely privileged people from elite backgrounds. You know, these are people who went to Yale and other elite schools. One of the attorneys is the niece of the former New York governor, Andrew Cuomo. Her name is Emily Cole. So her mother is Maria Cuomo Cole. So that's the sister of Andrew Cuomo. And her father is a fashion designer.
Kenneth Cole.
Yeah, Kenneth Cole. Exactly.
Who's also a Jewish identitarian of sorts.
Yes.
So
it runs through and through, and I don't mean to pick on them or anything, but it is what it is. This is an organized effort by that community, which is what it is.
Yeah, we're just noticing things, and someday noticing things might be against the law. That really is the driving force here. It's so interesting to see how their case doesn't make any sense. Based in existing U.S. law, but they believe that anything that makes them feel unsafe should be against the law. And basically, that's the doctrine that's being advanced here. Things that make Jews feel unsafe should be illegal. Thoughts that make Jews feel unsafe should be illegal. And they're having a devil of a time getting this across to the jury. I hope they're having a devil of the time. They're certainly not articulating it very well. This is real only in their own minds.
They're trying to recreate the classic ACLU free speech cases from the 60s and 70s, like the Nazi free speech case in Skokie. Skokie. Yeah. You know, I mean, they say again and again, well, we're not against free speech. If these guys were just standing on a street corner and reciting their hateful beliefs, then we wouldn't have a problem with it. But that's not how this works. I mean, I have videos up on my BitChute showing documentary footage of what it was like at that that Skokie rally and the marches that that Nazi party was doing at that time. These were not like people just standing off to the side like, gosh darn, you know, I don't like them protesting. It was just like it is today. People were showing up armed with guns to confront these guys. They were getting in to brawls with them, trying to stop them from marching. And the only way that it worked was because once the ACLU represented them and they won their case at the Supreme Court, the police showed up and forced the march to happen, not in Skokie, but in a nearby community. And the sides were kept separated. It was a highly policed event. So there's never been a time when people can go out in the streets and have really controversial protest, and it's just going to be nonviolent as far as the counter protesters are concerned. You have to be aware at all times that you're putting your safety at risk when you stand up for the free speech, stand up for the First Amendment that way.
Yeah, absolutely. The left, communists, they don't believe in freedom of speech. They believe in force, which is why they're the greatest mass murderers in history whenever they have the power to actually shut up their opponents. They shut you up by killing you, basically. These people are incredibly violent and vicious. They have no conscience. They do not play by liberal rules. And we simply have to have the state step in and protect us from them if we are going to maintain freedom of speech and freedom of assembly in America, freedom of political opinion.
Absolutely. I mean, you can't have it both ways. You can't tell people, well, you're not allowed to bring a shield to protect your head when people are throwing rocks and bags of like biohazardous materials and nasty things at you.
Frozen water bottles.
Yeah. Yeah. Bottles filled with concrete, things that could kill you. You can't do anything to protect yourself. But yet then the police aren't going to protect you either. We've got to have some uniformity in how these things are done. And that's what I'm trying to do through my legal efforts, is create a uniform standard where the police have to protect free speech going forward.
Yeah, this is enormously valuable because it's only going to get harder for us in the future as America keeps falling apart. And it would be nice to have some good legal decisions in favor of free speech and against communist violence. Remember, this happened in 2017. This happened more than 4 years ago. Since then, we've seen this play out in 300 cities across America in the form of Antifa and Black Lives Matter organized violence. This is not going away until the state actually cracks down on it. And it would be good to have a nice decision about this, definitely. So
it's critical that we have a good decision here, because don't forget, we've lost the ACLU. I mean, the ACLU was, when they were dedicated to free speech, it was the kind of thing where you could sit back and say, well, yeah, I support the ACLU. I'm glad they're around, even if I don't agree with them on every position. That's gone. And basically, the thin wall standing between us and losing our First Amendment rights is basically the Jason Kessler show right now. You've got to stand up and protect me because I'm putting my life on the line to stop these people from tearing down our rights.
Absolutely. So folks, throw in your DLive tokens and go to entropystream.live/countercurrents and leave a donation to help out. My Trail of Disgrace has donated 4 lemons. Thank you very much. And I hope those 4 lemons will be joined by many diamonds, lemons, ninjaginis, ninjets, ice cream, etc. Back over at Entropy. Let's see if we've got anything new here. All right. John, writes in with 50 Great Britain pounds. That's substantial. Thank you very much. He says, no question, just hope justice is done. Well, I very much appreciate that. So, Jason, what are your favorite moments of the trial so far? And can you name some of the things that have caused the jury to laugh?
Well, I love the jury selection, first of all, because it was the first moment where we put all of our discovery-related troubles behind us, and we're on a more even footing with the plaintiffs. They've just been beating us up mercilessly for so many years. And then to come in and see the jurors aren't buying all the left-wing propaganda, you know, they're not really spouting the talking points from the Washington Post or the Huffington Post or whatever. That was enormously invigorating, and it was such a great moment. I think that the opening statements were solid. You know, I think that you know, both Cantwell and Spencer have enormous speaking ability. They like speaking in public. And it's interesting to see performers do what they do best, you know, under extremely high pressure circumstances. I still think that the best is yet to come, though. I mean, really, until they get into my stuff, like, that's really when things are gonna accelerate. Because nobody knows this case, these events like I do. And they might want to bring me up there to beat me up. And sure, I've put my foot in my mouth on some things, and they'll bash me for that. But I know my facts. I know my things. I know what I did. I know I worked with the police. I know I tried to protect everybody, not just my protesters, but the counter protesters as well. I fought in court for that. And I was screwed over, you know, and so I will be able to meticulously show where I was either calling only for self-defense or total nonviolence, where we told people don't use tiki torches as weapons, where we told people not to bring knives, don't open carry guns. Fight back if you're attacked. Don't attack first. We were totally within our rights, and we're going to be able to go song and verse down all of this stuff once I'm on the stand. And so I'm looking forward to that.
Great. So are there some moments that have caused the jury to laugh? I'd love to know what some of the people in the courtroom have reported, just sort of reading the jury as they've been going through this trial. It's been going on now. Well, actually, the jury's been sitting there and listening to testimony for, what, 6 days, 7 days now?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of funny moments. I'm just trying to think, because so many things have happened over time. Most of the funny moments have to do with Cantwell. Cantwell can be quite humorous and is also, you know, tried his hand at being a stand-up comedian. The only thing that really is coming off at the top of my head immediately, there was that moment, like I said, where the witness was talking about who was in the crowd with the counter protesters when there were many violent, nasty communists in Antifa. And she was saying it was just moms and students. And then Cantwell said, and babies and puppy dogs. And she was like, well, no, there weren't any babies. But then he didn't say this, but it sort of begs the question, how do you know they're moms then if they don't have any kids with them? Right. You're just throwing out like sympathetic stock characters. And there was another moment recently. Richard Spencer gave some very bizarre answers when he was being questioned by Christopher Cantwell, just really not doing him any favors. For instance, Cantwell had asked him if Emily Gorchinsky is a member of Antifa, and he said, no, Antifa doesn't have members, which is like their propaganda line. It's ridiculous. But he also asked Spencer, am I the member of an organization? And Spencer said, yes, you are. And Cantwell was surprised. He was like, well, which organization is that? You're the member of the Radical Agenda podcast organization. And Cantwell asked him, and how many members does that have? And Spencer said, just one. Okay. And then
an organization of one. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess we all belong to organizations then.
Yeah.
There are billions of organizations on this planet. Yeah, that's a little weird. One of the things that I've been getting from people in the peanut gallery is a lot of talk about how we need to, we're all in this together. We need to present a united front, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I actually wrote a piece on this called Racial Solidarity and Moral Hazard. And I think there's some interesting questions here. I mean, if people who are on your team or who belong to your community or who have some tie to you, let's put it that way, if people who have some tie to you are being attacked wrongly, yeah, I think you should have absolute solidarity with them. But I think we all recognize it's pathological when you have knee-jerk solidarity for people in your community who are doing bad things, as including bad things to people in your own community. Black solidarity with black criminals against the police is an example of this pathological behavior, because black criminals mostly victimize black people, and yet black people have knee-jerk solidarity with criminals against the police. That just makes it possible for more of them to be victimized by the sociopaths that they coddle. That's a bad thing. So we can't have like absolute solidarity with our own guys if they're doing wrong things, because that creates a moral hazard. A moral hazard is a concept from insurance, basically, or business, where you create bad behavior by making it easier for people to do bad things, making it safer for people to do bad things. And so if you have a community where you commit a crime and everybody pulls together to stand with you against the police, that's a moral hazard, because that makes it easy for people to do bad things and you get more bad behavior. Okay. So all of this I think is important. And I get why though people want to say, let's have some solidarity with the defendants here, because we might have objections to them. We might think some of them are bad people, bring disgrace upon us, et cetera, right? But they're not being attacked because of the stuff we disagree with. They're being attacked because of the stuff that we agree with. They're being attacked for their virtues. They're being attacked for standing up for white people and white history. And that's something that we should rally around. And so I think out here in the audience, we should have some solidarity here. We should have some solidarity. However, there's another wrinkle to this, another nuance here that I think needs to be discussed. I don't think we should demand that Chris Cantwell have solidarity with Richard Spencer, or Richard Spencer have solidarity with Chris Cantwell, or Kessler and Spencer and so on and so forth, for the simple reason that, first of all, it's not true. I mean, there was a lot of infighting amongst these people at the rally. And after the rally, a lot of these people turned on one another and so on and so forth, threw people under the bus. And since the main charge against them is they were part of a conspiracy, the more solidarity we see amongst them in that courtroom, that actually supports the conspiracy charge. Whereas if we see these people contradicting one another and throwing one another under the bus like they did 4 years ago, that undermines a conspiracy charge. So I get why people want to have some solidarity with our guys when they're being victimized, but we don't have to demand that they fake a solidarity that actually would help the prosecution make their conspiracy case.
Yeah, there absolutely was not solidarity at the time, especially where I was concerned, where I had people turning on me left and right. I'm not sure who didn't turn on me at the rally. And so, I don't think that it's helpful to be overly argumentative about it. And I welcome the public, you know, to join in and see what we have to say for ourselves and get the information they need to be informed and so forth. But I'm not going to suppress the evidence of that infighting and the mutinies and different things that were going on there, because that substantially harms our case. What the plaintiffs want to show is that there was some solidarity amongst us, and there wasn't. So people need to understand that we're not being jerks or whatever if we bring up that the real conflicts that were going on between people during that rally. That is a necessary part of our defense.
Yeah. I think that's definitely true. And I think we need to cut these people a little slack. If there's a little back and forth between the defendants, like there was between Cantwell and Spencer, that's actually not a bad thing. I think that should happen because it reinforces the case that there was no conspiracy here. Let's check over at Entropy again and see if there are some new questions and comments here. Okay, nothing new and nothing new over at DLive. Folks, if you got some questions at DLive over here, let us know. Toss in some tokens and your questions along with them, and we'll get to them with Jason. So Jason, are there other things that people should know, things that I'm not asking about that I should have asked already?
Well, I'm just going through my Twitter feed. By the way, you can join in and listen to this thing for yourself every day. There's a 1-800 number with an access code you can join. It's not on TV and you can't record it or rebroadcast it. So you've got to listen live. But I do post a link every day during the week at 9 a.m. And it's a thread and I discuss what's going on. And we have a pretty active community, especially on Telegram, where I'm not as suppressed. And so that's at the Mad Dimension, and you can join me there. But I was looking through my Twitter feed, just trying to remind myself of some of the other things that happened that really I thought were humorous or caught my attention. There was something that happened, I think, on Friday where Cantwell was really kind of going off into left field with when he was cross-examining Richard Spencer, and he was trying to do a metaphor. Like, he asked him about the zombie apocalypse, and so the plaintiff's attorney jumped up and said, "Objection to the zombie apocalypse, Your Honor." And I thought that was pretty funny.
What was the substance of his objection? I mean, we all think zombie apocalypses are bad. What did he think that was objectionable about bringing it into the testimony? That's interesting.
I don't know. I think he thought that it was just too far afield from the facts of the case. Okay. There was another incident where Levine for the plaintiffs was cross-examining, or he was direct examining Michael Hill. And he brought up a statement that got him into an argument with Michael Hill about whether the Charlottesville courts are Jew run. And so Judge Moon told him to stop arguing about whether the courts are Jew run. I thought that was pretty absurd.
That's interesting. Yeah. Bad Goy Surf asks, did Kessler ever get FOIA for all the agency's communications? He said it was destroyed.
Well, I've gotten a lot of communications. I've gotten thousands of pages of communications. Some of the best stuff I got were really just FOIA requesting other FOIA requests. There was a Huffington Post journalist named Jessica Schulberg, and she was backed by the big pockets of Huffington Post, and she got thousands of pages, and those are enormously helpful. And I've actually written some articles, which are on my website, about that, and they've also been reposted on VDare, detailing the substance of those communications. Many I think the questioner is specifically asking about the text messages that were used in planning the police response to Unite the Right. So the Charlottesville Independent Review, otherwise known as the Hafey Report, says that the police chief Al Thomas destroyed his text messages related to the review. And and then later I tried to sue and get those text messages and the text messages of the city manager, Maurice Jones. And at that time I found out that the Jones text messages don't exist either. Like, and I've gotten conflicting statements from the city. At first they were saying that he had wiped his phone before leaving office, which is not lawful. That's illegal. And then that they said that, you know, perhaps the phone had just been damaged and was sitting in some storage facility. And so I've been fighting in court. I won a FOIA lawsuit against these people. And then I took it up to a higher court, to the circuit court, to try and enforce the Public Record Act, which says that they can't destroy the text. Unfortunately, I lost that one because the judge is saying that only the Library of Virginia has the authority to invoke the Public Records Act. So that essentially means that if there's some serious misconduct that a government official in Virginia does, all they have to do is destroy the documents, you know, and then they don't have to turn it over in FOIA because technically it doesn't exist. And the Library of Virginia has never, not even once, used the Public Records Act to try and discipline a locality for destroying records. So that's a shame. But on the other hand, it might not be a total lost cause just yet, because in the process of litigating that, we did pay a substantial sum of money to have this allegedly damaged phone analyzed by a forensic audit. So we're going to see if hopefully some things can be retained from that. Alternately, if we win our appeal for our offensive case, we're going to have subpoena power to try and get at some of this stuff. So it's not done yet, but they sure are making it difficult.
Well, they got something to hide. That's clearly the case. I hope you get to the bottom of this, because I think there's definitely a massive conspiracy here to deny you people your constitutional rights. So we had a question over at Odyssey, and let's see how many people are there. 91 people watching at Odyssey, and we have over at DLive. How many people at DLive? Almost 300. So we're closing in on 400 viewers. That is great. Folks, share the stream, get people over here. This is history, what's happening in Charlottesville. This could be extremely important. And you've got one of the guys who knows the most about this and who's been following this very, very carefully on here. So you can pick his brain. Let's hope that we get a few more people in here and a few more donations and comments to help out. So a person over at Odyssey asked, Jason, what do you think of Mike Enoch being dropped from the case? Did you follow the arguments that were made by Mike Enoch to get dropped from the case? And I guess a question I have is, why didn't more people follow that route?
Well, no one would have been successful in the same way that he was. They just did not allege sufficient facts against him. That was the deal. It's okay. Not like he had some magical ability. I know he said, you know, a lot of things about, well, I was filing this and I was following that and I was just too much of a hassle, so they wanted to get rid of me. But really, they just didn't allege sufficient facts against him. Part of the thing is I think he might have been a few steps ahead of the game compared to some other folks in terms of just not running his mouth as much on the internet, you know. The rest of us, we're just so addicted to the internet, and we're on Twitter, we're on Facebook, and just talking and talking endlessly, saying things we don't mean, saying careless things that, you know, can be used against us. And that was the deal there. And I don't know, it just seemed like maybe their research on him was pretty weak. I mean, just for example, like if Enoch was right there marching with James Fields, I mean, he was literally in the same line, like a few people away. If they'd put that in their complaint, I mean, he would still be right there with us, but they didn't put that in there. So Enoch, it just came to light. Apparently, I don't know how the hell they got his emails, but I guess Enoch had a good attorney, you know,
a fantastic attorney. Yeah.
Yeah. He had a stand up guy named Glenn Allen, who is a great supporter of the First Amendment, you know, and he was able to see these holes in the complaint from a mile away. And so it's not disparaging of the other attorneys that are, you know, on this case. It's just that Enoch in particular, you know, had a good case to be dropped from this thing.
That's great. Yeah. And Glenn Allen is a excellent attorney. He was an attorney at one of the best law firms in the United States for some time. So he really knows his stuff. Well, and so we lucked out having this guy in his corner. And yeah, I would love to know how that that email got leaked. That's an interesting question. It was reported by the SPLC, I believe, that Glenn Allen was helping Mike Enoch get out of the Charlottesville case. I mean, Mike Enoch is an extremely online guy. So, you know, but for whatever reason, apparently they didn't put enough facts forward to make it easy to, you know, keep him stuck in the case or he'd still be there. So folks, help Jason out. Go to givesendgo.com/unite the right and jasonkessler.us/donate. He's doing historically very, very important work here, and we need to come together and help him out. So share the stream. We've still got about 20 minutes to go. I'd like to get over 400 people in on this. And of course, many, many more people will hear this later when it goes out. So we're not going to put this one behind the paywall because it's so topical. We want this to be immediately available. So we hope it'll snowball and get some more donations. And of course, if we put it behind the paywall for 30 days, when it comes out, the trial will be over. So this is something too topical and too important to paywall. So there will be hundreds and hundreds of more people, thousands more listening to this in the days to come. But you, if you want to be one of the people who gets their questions answered, help us out today. Go to entropystream.live/countercurrents or send one of your diamonds, lemons, ninja guineas, etc. And include a question, and we will get to it before the show is out. So let's talk about the behavior of some of the lawyers for the plaintiffs. I'm told some of these people are really obnoxious. And do you think they're making a good impression?
You know, not being there in person, I don't see the jury. So I can't tell, and I never want to underestimate how different the mindset of just the normal man and woman on the street is from me or any other political dissident. But I don't think that they come across nearly as likable as the defendants, even with the speech that they probably find objectionable. I know Levine, when he was cross-examining Hill, was extremely aggressive. The same thing with Dunn. Karen Dunn has been the same way. They just seem like perturbed, and they've got this constant air of moral indignation, talking about, you know, First Amendment protected statements and so forth. And I just don't think that kind of thing comes across as very likable. And the fact that many of the defendants seem relaxed and are happy to share their views and often have funny or affable statements in response is really putting a sharp contrast to these humorless scolds. So, I don't think that they're coming across well. And they're really being covered up for by the media. So if you were going to read a media account, say in the Washington Post, about the cross-examination or the direct examination of Richard Spencer by Michael Block, for instance, you're going to get a totally one-sided fictional account where it shows all of the missteps by Richard Spencer, but it doesn't show that, like, Judge Moon had to interrupt and chastise this attorney, Michael Block, over and over again. It must have been dozens of times. And at times there were not just professional, but like profound disagreements between these people where the judge had to scold him for basically toying with Richard Spencer, torturing him. And he said, "Sir, you know, I mean, any first year law student worth his salt would know not to ask a witness something that they already know, you know, or something that you've already proven." So he's just screwing with his witness. And yeah. I don't think that came across well at all, as in particular because the judge, who is seen as a venerable figure in that courtroom, is saying, "Hey, something is wrong here with the way you guys are acting."
That's very interesting. Dunn apparently was quite obnoxious too. Say a little bit about her behavior.
Yeah, it's the same thing. Just very angry, giving off very like Hillary Clinton vibes is the way that I could put it. And these people are all, you know, they all look up to Hillary Clinton and work with her and know her personally and so forth. It's just that mean, nasty, like, ladder climbing type of political woman, you know, that
sharp elbows, you know, out of my way.
Yeah. They'll use everybody in the room as a stepping stone to get what they want, kind of thing.
Interesting. Do you think any of the lawyers for the plaintiffs have come off affable or likable or logical?
I mean, it's a really hard thing for me to say, but I think relative to the others, probably Roberta Kaplan has come off less unlikable than the others. But it's mostly, I think, because she hasn't really been doing anything. She's been very quiet for the majority of the time. So the only thing she's done was sort of like she did a small part of the opening statement where she basically only covered the the plaintiffs. So Karen Dunn like went into her spiel, attacking the defendants. And then at the very end, Kaplan came in and told the story of the noble plaintiffs. And then who did Kaplan did the direct examination of Deborah Littstadt. So she's not doing hostile interviews. The hostile, examinations are the ones where the people are going to come across looking aggressive or mean. Kaplan is seemingly purposely framing herself as like the good attorney. And maybe it could be a strategy. It could be like saving up goodwill towards like maybe there's a particular witness that she's going to go all in on, you know, and she wants to save up that goodwill beforehand. That's my impression.
That's interesting. A friend of mine, a friend of mine who was in the courtroom part of the time told me that there seems to be some dissent, some lack of harmony, some enmity amongst people in the who are arguing for the plaintiffs. That some of these lawyers are like, you know, staring daggers at one another and things like that. Can you comment on any of that? That would be very, very interesting if these people are not getting along with one another.
Well, without being in the courtroom, I'm not able to get a clear sign of those fine details of human communication, you know, that are like the body language and stuff. I mean, I have a video that I can watch. So unlike the people who are only listening to the audio line, I have a little bit more information. But, it's the people are too far away. The video is not a super high definition. Mm-hmm. And it's just that one overhead angle for a while, you know, it's mm-hmm. not like I can look and notice different details, but I do pick up on some things. At least I definitely pick up on details when I feel like my attorney or one of the other attorneys has gotten a good shot in, and then I can hear like Roberta Kaplan's voice faltering or something, and I can tell that they're not 100% confident in what's going on. Mm-hmm. things like that.
Okay, well, let's do one quick look at entropy and see if there are some more questions here. All right, and let's see if there are more people at DLive who have tossed in, chipped in. So yeah, we've had a number of people who have been chipping in. Kimberly has donated 2 ice cream, Giddy55, 6 ice cream. Arthur Vikas has donated 11 ice cream. Old Man Yinzer, 1 diamond and 2 diamonds and 3 diamonds and 4 diamonds. And Mile Trail of Disgrace, 1 more lemon. That is great. Thank you very much, folks. So let me just ask you how to wrap this up. What's next? What are we going to be seeing next week? And then we can talk about how folks can follow your work more closely, your commentary on the trial, and again, help you out with your fight. So what's coming up in the coming week?
Well, there's still a lot. I mean, a big part of this case is supposed to be not what actually happened at the event itself, but like people talking, shit posting, and online chat rooms. And that's really the Kessler specific thing, because they can't credibly claim that I was involved in any kind of violence or something. So they want to attack my speech and say that my speech shouldn't be First Amendment protected. So we're going to get into all of that, and that ties into the expert witnesses that where they're going to talk about their coded language and their other conspiracy theories. And I think that that'll be a fascinating discussion for people. And these are all like big concepts of the trial that we haven't really gotten into yet. It really has been mostly like on the ground, what transpired. Like I said, I'm very excited to be able to do my testimony, even though I'm going to be grilled. I'm going to be on the hot seat. They're going to throw a lot of things at me. But at the end of that, I'm going to be able to tell my side of the story directly to these jurors. And I know more than anybody else what was done to keep this thing safe. People who are in a racially motivated conspiracy don't involve the police. Hey, police, please, please come here and watch me do illegal acts. No, that is not what people who are doing something unlawful do. So those are going to be exciting things. And you have the X factors of how the pro se litigants Cantwell and Spencer are going to react. You have some plaintiffs who are definitely on the less sympathetic side of the scale. Like I said, Seth Whispleway is coming up, and I think he's just going to be a huge albatross. I think even more than Lipstadt. I think it was a huge mistake for them to make this guy a plaintiff, and he is going to really help to unravel this case. So it's going to be fascinating watching someone like Cantwell do the cross-examination, and I'll hopefully be able to get my attorney to do some stuff on this guy as well. Although, you know, Whispleway's allegations are pretty weak. So we'll see. We'll see about all of that. There's a lot more that I'm not aware of. We might get Steve Young, the police detective who investigated the James Fields homicide case. There seems to be some ambiguity over whether he's actually going to be able to testify fully, because the plaintiffs are trying to muzzle this guy, because he has stated under oath at depositions that, you know, he looked and he looked and he looked, and the FBI looked for any evidence of communication between James Fields and the organizers about the death of Heather Heyer or organizing the rally or something. And there just wasn't anything like that. So that's going to be incredibly powerful for the jury to hear that. And I'm really hoping we're going to be able to get that in.
That's great. That's absolutely great. Bucky writes in and says, how is Spencer Prose with all the money he has?
Well, that's a big mystery, you know, and I talk to people who know Spencer and I say, well, he just must be out of money or he's relying on the trust fund and he doesn't think that maybe the lawsuit will be able to touch the trust fund money or something. But people say, no, he does have money. So I don't understand that. I don't know the guy very well, but he just seems like he's so heavily focused on this intellectual, philosophical stuff. And all of his brain cells are, you know, situated in that column. And he has so little common sense, so little ability to handle mundane affairs, to handle responsibilities. I've just been mystified about the fact that this guy has been devoting so much of his time pontificating about politics in America and political elections when he should have been hustling to do what he needed to do to get an attorney and fight in this thing. I can't imagine how humiliating it's got to be to show up to that courtroom, you know, not represented by counsel, the former leader of a political movement reduced to what he is, and everybody, you know, that's writing about it is picking up on it. I can't for the life of me figure why this guy was wasting his time devoting himself so fully to being an internet celebrity when he had real responsibilities of historical import to take care of. I have no idea what's going on in that guy's head.
Yeah, it is a mystery. He is very much focused on appearances and very lacking in substance. And I wonder if in his mind he thinks this is good. This is fine. What's the meme of the little dog in the burning room? This is fine. He might think that he's getting a lot of attention and this is fine. This is good. By his standards, this is good. I just don't know. It is kind of a mystery what makes that guy tick. So how do people follow your work and especially your trial coverage? Because there's going to be a lot more coverage of this. And you're, like I said, you're probably the best commentator on this because you know more about this, I would wager, than anybody who's involved on either side. So yeah, how do people follow your commentary?
Well, I'm trying to cross post on Twitter, Telegram, and Gab. On Gab, I'm at Jason Kessler. On Twitter and Telegram, I'm at The Mad Dimension. I'm really excited about the Telegram platform because it's grown a whole lot during this trial, and we've been able to, you know, have a really active community in the chat and so forth. I love, you know, the community on Twitter as well, but the problem is that it's so heavily suppressed to a absurd degree. If you go on Twitter and type in The Mad Dimension, like I don't even come up. There's fake accounts with no avatars that pop up, and I don't. If you wouldn't mind, Greg, maybe you could just stop over onto my Telegram and share a post or something just so that people can find me on there, because that's really the platform that is the best for people who want to engage with me right now.
Okay. Yeah, definitely. And Gaddius just put your link, your Telegram link in the chat. Awesome. So I think that's a good way of doing it too. Well, I really want to thank you for coming on. I want to thank the donors who have helped out. I want to thank the moderators in the chat who always do good work. And I want to thank the audience. You make a lot possible. You make Countercurrents possible. And it's donors like you, supporters like you, who make Jason's work possible. And his work connected with Charlottesville is not confined to fighting this case. He's not just fighting rear guard defensive actions. He's offensive. He's on the offense. He's going against the people who actually created this. He's filing lawsuits. He's filing FOIA requests. He is dragging information into the light. And this is tremendously important work, again, if we're going to fight this fake narrative about what happened at Charlottesville. And if you roll your eyes and get sick about hearing these stories about the March on Selma and Black people having water hoses turned on them and stuff like that, most of that's probably as much rubbish as what's being said about Charlottesville. But those lies are now part of the historical record. We can prevent that from happening here. And Jason is the most important person to do that. So please, folks out there, help him out. So Jason, thank you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Greg. And I really appreciate your support. I just want to make sure that the audience recognizes that Greg is supported even when this wasn't actually happening, when it wasn't a big story. In the lean times, Greg was helping out. And so I think there's a lot of honor in that, and he should get respect and praise for that. And I also want to thank everybody who has donated today so far, in addition to the stuff that has gone through Entropy and DLive. I see some people have sent Bitcoin and also donated on the Gives and Go. So I greatly appreciate that, guys.
Yeah. And another way that you can help out, if you are an old fashioned ink and paper kind of guy, if you want to send a check or something to Jason, just get in touch with Jason or get in touch with me. We can work something out. But it is important to help in any way that you're comfortable, at any amount that you're comfortable. So folks, thank you again. And we will be back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. Tomorrow, however, at 4 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, 1 o'clock Pacific Time, and whatever time that is in Europe, Nick Gilvey will be on Countercurrents Radio with the Writer's Block, and he's going to be doing a monthly show, the best month ever, because every month at Countercurrents is the best month ever, and it's going to be a retrospective of the best of Countercurrents in October, and the guest is Jim Goad. So folks, if you want to hear Jim and Nick talking about Countercurrents' best month ever, tune in tomorrow at the Writer's Block. Thank you so much, and we will be back again with another episode of Countercurrents Radio, same time next week.